Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. We are ready to hear our first case of the morning, ABA Retirement Funds against the United States. Mr. Flint.
May it please the court, my name is Tacey Flint. I'm here on behalf of ABRA. ABRA was founded and exists.
If you could use real words rather than acronyms, I think it would help those of us who don't spend our lives worrying about the American Bar Retirement Program.
ABA Retirement Funds.
You could call them the funds, even if you wanted to.
All right. ABA Retirement Funds, the Retirement Funds, was founded and exists to promote the use and availability of tax-qualified retirement plans for lawyers.
Isn't that what Fidelity does, too? I mean, they have funds that can be used by people out there in the market.
That's true. There's a very important distinction between ABA Retirement Funds, which, as I answer this question, I will not name the funds, and Fidelity. ABA Retirement Funds doesn't maintain funds. It doesn't maintain the program's funds. That's all handled by State Street. State Street is the administrator of the program.
But why is it significant that there is no in-house staff, as you describe it, for the ABA Retirement Funds, and instead they've chosen to contract the operation of the retirement programs that they offer with somebody else, State Street in this instance?
Well, it's very significant because State Street is not, really can't be analogized to an employee of ABA Retirement Funds.
I guess I'm unclear why that matters. They're certainly an agent. They're hired by ABA Retirement Funds. They're performing services.
Your Honor, I disagree. I don't think they're certainly an agent. It's correct that they're selected by ABA Retirement Funds and that ABA Retirement Funds has the authority to terminate State Street's role in the program. But State Street is not required to follow any instructions by ABA Retirement Funds.
But listen to how that sounds. They're hired by them and they can be terminated. And so if State Street says, after a conversation with a relevant person from the funds, you know, we've decided not to do it that way, and the person at the fund doesn't like that, they can be terminated. This is probably good business for State Street.
That's true. Termination is obviously a very significant authority.
Do you think the Attorney General is an agent of the President?
The Attorney General certainly acts. The President obviously has the authority to terminate the Attorney General.
Well, hiring and firing power.
It's a rare contract.
So if you think the Attorney General is an agent of the President, why isn't State Street an agent of the ABA?
It's a very rare contract between a principal and agent. And in fact, contrary to the most basic principle of principal and agent law, that an agent is required to follow the instructions of the principal, including intermediate instructions. Terminating and selection.
Well, wait a minute. I don't get that at all. There could easily be a principal-agent relationship in which the principal instructs the agent, here are the broad goals that I'm engaging you to accomplish. Inside each of those goals, I'm not only not dictating what you have to do, I don't even want to be bothered with how you go about doing it. I'm entrusting you as an expert, let's say, to do this. So I don't know. I mean, there could be other principal-agent relationships where there's a huge deal of micromanagement, but it's not necessary.
That's true. It is certainly possible to give discretion to an agent, but an agent must, if a principal chooses to revoke the discretion, if a principal chooses to provide an instruction contrary to its earlier wish not to provide an instruction, earlier expectation, the agent is required to follow it, but this contract.
So let me ask you a factual question about the State Street arrangement. Was this an at-will arrangement? Was it for particular terms of years? What's the duration?
I'm not sure of the answer to that question. I think it was renewed on an annual basis. Was what I think, but okay. I could be incorrect.
So the reason I'm asking is, it sounds to me then like, on a once-a-year basis, the ABA retirement funds could evaluate whether they were happy with the way State Street was exercising its discretion.
That's very true.
And
they actually had
or not.
ABA retirement funds had a fiduciary obligation to evaluate how State Street was performing. But what's very important about the division of labor between ABA Retirement Funds and State Street is that ABA Retirement Funds, while it oversaw what State Street did and monitored it consistent with its fiduciary obligations, ABA Retirement Funds had no involvement in the day-to-day administration of the program.
So I want to take you back, though, to this broader question of business league, because even if all six of these factors that the district court identified might not point in the same direction, I find it very difficult to look at what the ABA Retirement Funds were doing and understand this as anything but services for individuals rather than the industry as a whole, services performed for consideration. In fact, it was a fairly profitable business, whether you put it in a profit box or a reinvested earnings box or what have you doesn't really interest me. And something that's therefore outside the scope of a business league, as the courts and the Internal Revenue Service have understood that.
The reason I think that's incorrect, Judge Wood, is that ABA Retirement Funds, as sponsor of the program, did not interact with individual participants. It did not provide services to individual participants. It sponsored the program. Sure, it's a but-for cause of services that individual participants ended up receiving from State Street. But here's the crucial point. If the program had 100 participants, or if it had 1,000 participants, ABA Retirement Fund's role in the program did not change.
But here's what I guess I have a logical problem with your argument. You seem to think that as soon as you can characterize ABA Retirement Funds as a sponsor, that's the end of the discussion. And what I understand from at least what I've read is that sponsorship may describe the relationship between the retirement funds and the State Streets of the world, the entities that are running the program. But it's not sufficient to say that you're a business league, to say that you're a sponsor. Some sponsors may be business leagues, other sponsors may not be. We've got to look at who's being benefited. Is this really just a business in competition with other comparable businesses out there in the market? And I'm not convinced that lawyers are so unique that other entities, whether they're sponsors or anything else, are not fully in competition with ABA Retirement Funds. ABA's own literature seems to support that.
As far as we know, there is no other entity that does what ABA Retirement Funds, which is to say, sponsor a master plan. This is a plan that any lawyer can adopt, any legal employer can adopt. This is a prepackaged retirement plan where ABA Retirement Funds has done the work of creating the retirement plan documents.
But it's for the individual lawyer. It's not the Washington State Apple Advertising Commission saying, eat apples, they're good for you, and it doesn't really matter which orchard they came from or which grower.
I think it's pretty settled that expanding retirement planning generally is to the public good.
But and for that every industry in the country, doctors shouldn't do retirement planning, accountants shouldn't, business executives shouldn't. I mean, it's just too broad an argument.
Lawyers have a specific need for retirement plans. The California Bar
Why
has told
us this. Why is it different from the needs of a doctor?
There may be similarities of the needs for a doctor.
No, but I asked you, what's the difference?
Oh. One difference is, as the California Bar has told us, the reputation of the entire bar, we know from various sources, suffers if particular lawyers practice poorly, if particular lawyers call
that, that's not true of doctors. You know, some doctor botches your brain surgery and everybody's so well.
Doctors. And maybe I would be making the same argument if I were up here representing the AMA retirement funds. But that doesn't make it untrue for the law, which is the key question here.
Well, no, you said law was different, and I take you now to be conceding that law actually isn't really different from many other endeavors.
I said there is a specific need for lawyers, that's true. And I think that that is firmly established. I'm not saying law is the only industry for which that is true in the world.
And which industries is it not true for? Can you think of one? we want incompetent people in the industry of X.
Well,
you know?
Your Honor, if I could ask you a question. I don't see any factor for which it matters that law is the only industry in the world or that law is one of a select group of industries for which retirement planning is important.
Well, but what you have been arguing is that this focuses on a business league, and business leagues and chambers of commerce and the like, according to the regulatory definitions, have to be advancing the general interests
right.
of that sector, if you will. You know, it can be defined in a number of ways, but I'm having trouble seeing how that element is met here.
ABA Retirement Funds does enhance the practice of law by making retirement plans more broadly available to lawyers. Whether, you know, the AMA Retirement Funds could do that for doctors is sort of a separate question that's beside the point. The question that I'm hoping to answer is whether ABA Retirement Funds actually does promote the interests of the legal profession by making retirement planning more broadly available to the legal profession.
So suppose the American Bar Association now decides, having its experience with the retirement funds under its belt, to create a new entity called ABAIT. And ABAIT is out there and performs information technology services for law firms, and maybe they have special deals negotiated with Westlaw and Lexis and the like. Would you say that ABAIT is also a business league?
I wouldn't. Retirement plans are, whether or not law is unique, retirement plans are unique. We know that the policy of promoting retirement plans inures to the public good, not strictly to the person who actually adopts a retirement plan. And the IRS itself has said that sponsoring a retirement plan, if a trade association chooses to sponsor a master plan for its members, that is consistent with business league status. That shows that retirement planning, promoting the availability of retirement planning, is different from promoting access to information technology or promoting access to desk chairs. You know, people might like to have desk chairs, but that doesn't.
Well, but I said IT precisely because it seems to me you could easily make an argument that it facilitates the practice of law to have good access to first-rate IT services. Lawyers rely on these on a daily basis at this point. It's impossible to imagine practicing law without that. And so I'm not sure that it's all that different. Except that, of course, it does, like your retirement plan example, compete with other vendors in the market.
ABA Retirement Funds doesn't compete with other vendors in the market.
It depends how we characterize it. If we characterize it your way, that it's just this group of people, it's the ABA Board of Governors, essentially.
Well, Your Honor,
and I don't even know what they're doing. The focus of the IRS has been the money earned through the agency relationship with State Street.
A couple of points about that. To speak to the fees first, and thank you for raising that. The fees that we earn are quite disproportionate from the work that we do. And this is an important distinction between retirement plan sponsors and retirement plan administrators. As I was saying before, the work that we do doesn't change depending on how many participants there are. And our fees, likewise, are set to match our costs, our three employees, our rent.
They're dependent on assets, though, right?
They're calculated on assets, but they're reviewed. They're reviewed so that what we end up taking home matches our costs, and they're revised accordingly. So our fees, if there are more participants in the program, our fees overall are still set to our costs. If someone removes their assets from the program, if new participants join the program, State Street, which administers the program, it's the one that works with them. It's the one that provides particular services to them.
So wait a minute, though. On your tax returns for 2000, 2001, and 2002, the ABA Retirement Funds report a gross income of $1.8 million, $1.6 million, $1.6 million, roughly, I'm rounding, with taxable incomes of $672,000, $384,000, $411,000. That doesn't sound like a match to costs to me.
You're right. In those years, it didn't. It didn't match. But as the evidence showed, those years were atypical. Mr. Petz testified that those years were atypical and that other years hadn't been the same.
Why does that legally matter if you earn a lot of money or a little?
But my point is, what we earn is targeted to the amount of work we do, which is not does not vary based on the number of participants in the program. The fact that 10,000 participants could join the program or 500 participants could join the program and nothing we would do would change, I think makes quite clear that we're not providing particular services to those 10,000 individuals or 500 individuals or however many there are.
How long have you been doing this for members of the bar?
ABA Retirement Funds was founded in 1962.
And when did you discover that you really shouldn't be paying taxes?
When did we seek tax exemption? Is that the question?
Right.
For the year 2000 was the first year.
And why was that?
There's a list of reasons, one of which is that in other years we had no positive income, so it didn't matter. The way ABA retirement funds operated in other years was different. ABA retirement funds took fees in a different way and had a different role in the program in earlier years than it did in later years. New counsel, a variety of reasons. But, you know, our decision not to seek an exemption in prior years, of course, is not preclusive of this application for an exemption under the law. And
so,
I see that I'm... Oh, I'm sorry.
I have one more question, but go ahead. You can... It had to do with the fact that you weren't making any money up to the point where you started making money, and then you thought you should be tax exempt.
Well, that's why tax exemption exists.
Well, I understand that.
If there are no further questions, I'll reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Flint. Ms. Rubin.
Good morning. May it please the court, my name is Jennifer Rubin, and I represent the United States in this case. And I would like to start by addressing some of the points that were made during my opponent's argument and to try to be consistent with what was done during the opening. I'm going to try to refer to the ABA retirement funds as the funds. The first point is that there seems to be a lot of discussion as to whether just by being a plan sponsor they had these particular duties and it was somehow separate from being in charge of the administration or management of the plan. And I would point the court to A69 to 70 of the record, which are paragraphs 21 to 25 of the stipulation of facts. And in particular, paragraph 21 tells you that the reason why ABA retirement funds had the range of duties that they did is because the plan gave it to them. Specifically, paragraph 21 says that ABA retirement funds was fiduciary under ERISA section 321A because the plans give it, quote, discretion or control over the assets of plans because it had the discretion to engage, monitor, and terminate vendors. Paragraphs 20 to 22 of the stipulation make clear that by doing so, by taking on those fiduciary duties, ABRA, along with its trustee that it chose and that had the power to fire, took over fiduciary duties that otherwise the law firms would have to hire someone to do. 23, paragraph 23 of the stipulation lists a host of other duties that ABRA did. And 24 to 25 explains that, in fact, that's why they got a, quote, program expense fee. It was because of the services that it did in connection with the program.
So can I ask you, though, the case I would like you to discuss is the Eighth Circuit's decision, American Academy of Family Physicians, which is a sponsorship situation. So I'm wondering if the government thinks that case was just wrongly decided or whether you see some significant difference between that situation and this one.
Well, I don't think we actually agree necessarily with the Academy case, but I do think the Academy case is an interesting one because the whole group insurance plans actually go quite along with something that Your Honor said during my opponent's argument, and that is that being a sponsor may lead to continuing to be a business league may lead to not being exempt, or in the case of the academy, it might mean that actually none of the income is taxable at all. And I'd like to go through that. Let's start with the academy case. The academy case, what the court found were two things. First of all, it said you're not getting any service fees. You're getting paid money for interest on reserves that you own. That's not true here. Here, they're getting, as they admit, a program service fee for services that they did in connection with this program. It also found that the academy did not have any administrative duties. Again, that's not true here. So they've acknowledged they had a number of duties, including most particularly to select, monitor, and potentially terminate their vendors.
So was the academy an ERISA fiduciary?
I don't believe so. No, that was a group insurance plan, so it wasn't under ERISA, but I think under that, my guess is that probably they have a good argument to say they weren't. It's my understanding that just simply being a plan sponsor doesn't make you a fiduciary. It's to actually having discretion, discretionary authority, as Abbott did, as the funds admitted they did in the stipulation of facts, paragraph 21. Now, on the other extreme, you have the Associated Master Barbers case. And in that one, because it was a primary activity to have this group insurance plan and to administer it, as it was a primary activity here, as the funds quite correctly has acknowledged, the court found, actually, you don't have tax exemption. You don't get to be a business league anymore. Too much of your activities are not business league activities. And then you have all the groups cases in the middle. American Bar Endowment, this court's decision in the Illinois Association of Professional Insurance Agents, Professional Insurance Agents of Michigan, Louisiana Credit Union League, Carolina's Farms. And those entities got to keep their tax exemption as business league, except they had to pay unrelated business income tax on the income related to the insurance plans. And this, I think, is an answer to much of what is said in their reply brief in particular, which goes into, we're a plan sponsor, and are you saying that every plan sponsor would not be eligible for business league? And the answer, of course, is no. You have to look at the facts just as Judge Wood stated during the opening argument. And in this instance, what we have really is a situation where one of the primary activities, we would probably say the primary activity, really, was the program.
So they argue very strenuously that the other thing ABA Retirement's funds did was to just put out there, as far as I can tell, for the entire globe, not just the legal profession, sample plans that had been vetted by the IRS that could just be used as an off-the-shelf plan. And so they were saving people, and this was just a freebie that they provided. And they say when you look at all of their activity, the free activity as well as the plan activity, they shouldn't lose the business league status, or they shouldn't be denied the business league status, I should say.
No, I think if you look at the bulk of the cases, including Associated Master Barbers and MIB, you actually look to see, are they engaged in a business that really is the provision of particular services to individual members. And the fact that there might be other things that a particular organization does, which might be considered a business league activity, doesn't alter the fact that in this instance, they're not a primary activity is providing particular services for individual persons. So we say you should only look at the program. But there's a lot of other issues with their free plan document argument. I mean, the first of which, they don't have any evidence that anybody ever accessed or used them. Realistically speaking, a plan document's pretty useless unless it comes combined with several other things, such as an adoption agreement, which is not available on their website, such as investment services. And the fact is, if you look at their plan is tailored, the plan documents are tailored to this particular trust that they have set up. It's tailored to ABRA selecting the trustee. It doesn't identify who the trustee is. It doesn't provide any standards for terminating the trustee. That's located separately in the contract with State Street. Yes, the plan gives the funds the ability to terminate, to monitor, and all of those things which with State Street. But realistically speaking, this plan document as it stands is not something that could very easily be used by anybody without a lot of additional work. You know, and I also think if you look at MIB and
so what would, excuse me, just to finish that thought, what evidence would you expect? I mean, they say in their brief, well, it was free. You know, how would we know who was picking it up and making the necessary modifications and filling in the blanks or whatever else had to be done? How should somebody go about proving whatever the other things are you think are missing?
I'm not entirely sure, and you certainly see this in the cases. You know, the MIB case made clear that there were claims of industry benefit that couldn't be measured. They said, well, the fact that it couldn't be measured, but that you actually charged fees for what could be measured, we think is actually a very significant fact. Mm-hmm. And we tend to agree with that. Here you have a host of alleged industry benefits with absolutely no measures attached to them, no proof behind them. And what we do have is proof that the funds were charging fees on the same basis that every other investment entity actually does charge, which is assets in the trust.
And then they did have this rather low fee for the self-directed trusts where you just had to have 5% in the general one.
Again, a couple things on that. The first thing is you don't have to show perfect proportionality. What you really need to show is a quid pro quo where, you know, MIB makes an interesting statement. They say, you know, you can't find any cases. You know, the appellee hasn't pointed out, the court didn't point out to us, because in that case they were reversing the tax court, any cases where such a high proportion of the revenues were from direct service charges for direct services. And here, that's what you have. You have really all of their revenue was either from direct service charges or earnings off of those direct service charges that someone had paid to them.
You know, I think they would agree with you. I mean, once that critical step is taken to link State Street to the ABA retirement funds, there's actually nothing else left of this case. If you sever it the way they would like to, they don't earn anything. You know, I mean, they don't do anything. As far as I can tell, they're just sitting there. If you see the State Street people as the agent, essentially, as the implementer of the plans, and everything State Street does is for the benefit of ABA retirement funds, the case is over in the other direction.
I'd like to unpack that question and answer part of it first. The first is we don't agree that they don't do anything separate from State Street because they actually do take on fiduciary duties, as they explain in A69 paragraph 21, from the law firms by virtue of the fact that they monitor and select, monitor, and terminate State Street. Fact is, you can't simply hire a trustee as an ERISA plan administrator, which is what the employers are. The employers are the plan administrator here. And just let them go and ignore them and think that you're done. And so the fact that they take those on, and this is acknowledged, again, if you look at paragraphs 20 and 22, and those are correct statements of the law. The law firms would otherwise have these duties that are being performed by the funds. And that's a matter of fact. It's a matter of law. But the second point is, absolutely, you can tie State Street to the funds. And I'd like to point you to something that was cited for the first time in the reply brief, and that is Restatement Third of Agency, Section 1.01, Comment F1. And they isolate a line out from this comment to say, oh, you have to have control. And then they say, we don't have control because we can't absolutely dictate what State Street did. But if you read the comments in there entirely, and particularly Comment C and Comment F of Section 1.01 of Restatement Third of Agency, this is not an accurate statement as to how control works in this context. Under Comment C makes clear that you may have agency even if you don't have authority to control all activities or the use of professional judgment. Comment F1, and I want to quote this, you still have control even if, quote, the principal has previously agreed with the agent that the principal will not give interim instructions to the agent or will not otherwise interfere in the agent's exercise of discretion, unquote. Ultimately, what these comments tell you is that you look to a couple things. As Judge Wood said during the opening argument, in the outset of the relationship, did you initially give general or specific instructions? That's comment F1. The answer here, of course, is yes, in the contract. Secondly, are you able to assess the performance and terminate if they don't meet the satisfactory requirements? That's in comment C. Yes, that's in the contract and in practice. It's very clear they had the ability to terminate. That reminds me, I wanted to answer another question that Judge Wood asked during the opening argument. She asked if this was an at-will relationship, and the answer there is yes. There were four-year term contracts, but if you look at each contract, and I'm specifically looking at document 37-1 at 23, section 15.03, the funds had the ability to terminate State Street with 6 months' notice if they were unsatisfied. And ultimately, they did terminate State Street. I'm not sure of the date. I believe it was somewhere around 2008. And, it appears that it was because they were unhappy with their performance. And that also brings me to another point, which is, fact is, yes, State Street was marketing and trying to increase participants, but that was because, at least in part, because the contract required it of them.
Is this the $1 million in marketing part that you're talking about?
Right. They were required both to spend at least more than $1 million every year to try to market the program. But also they were required to increase participants by an average of over 1,000 participants a year. In short, they were supposed to be increasing the fund's market share. When we sit here and we say, look, the funds were involved in, they were promoting their program, and they were seeking to increase the market share of their program. The contracts are perfect proof of this.
Do we have evidence in the record of what their market share was in the legal market?
I'm not trying to point you to a particular point, but every 3 months, State Street provided basically a marketing report to the board. And the board considered it. They had a quarterly meeting about it where they went over the performance. And in that, they actually talked about what their market share was and how many participants they had added. During some of them, there was a big deal about the fact
who was that... Who's the competitor of the fund? Who are the competitors?
I would look at, this is going to be A70 to 71, paragraphs 26 to 27. It talks about how competitors included for-profit entities such as mutual funds.
Just general mutual funds.
That's right, because banks, mutual funds, they can all sponsor retirement plans that would be considered to be tax exempt, and they were all competing for lawyer business, which of course makes sense. Lawyer business can be profitable for a retirement plan provider. Sort of circling back, we tend to agree with Judge Wood's statement that ultimately their argument is too broad. They're trying to make an argument here that says if there's any sort of side benefits, any sort of potential alleged benefits to the industry because someone practices law better, that somehow that means that there's a tax exemption. And here what we have is somebody who's engaged in a business that is routinely engaged in by for-profit businesses. In exchange for fees, they took on fiduciary duties that otherwise these law firms would have had. And they made a big profit off of that. And they had absolutely zero dues. And as MID makes clear, we can't find any cases where somebody didn't have was basically being funded by direct service charges for services that they provided and got Business League exemption. That's really what we were arguing in the dues section of our brief with National Muffler, the briefs and statements. You really have an entity here that was competing in the marketplace both by itself. It offered itself as a bundled package. We, along with the trustee that we choose, that we will monitor, and that we could terminate, pay us, and we'll lift all of these fiduciary duties from you. As my opponent stated during her opening argument, prepackaged retirement plans, exactly. That's what they were selling, and that's what they were competing with these banks and mutual funds for. If there are no further questions,
No, apparently not. Thank you. Anything further, Ms. Flint?
I think you probably have about 3 minutes.
Yeah.
One key point. My opponent talked about our administrative role. She suggested that there's a spectrum where some sponsors have no administrative role, other sponsors have bigger administrative roles, and where you fall on the spectrum determines the outcome. But she listed our supposed administrative roles, and they were selecting State Street, monitoring State Street, and creating the plan documents in the first place. And these are the same things she listed on page 47 of the government's brief. There's nothing unique about those activities. There's nothing special about our sponsorship of the program that would distinguish us from the sponsor of any other retirement plan. And yet the IRS has said that trade associations that sponsor master plans, just as we have sponsored the program, can be business leagues. That's exactly what Revenue Procedure 89.9 says. And we've never heard an identification of any action we take that would distinguish us from any other sponsor who is permitted as a business league to sponsor a retirement plan under Revenue Procedure 89.9. And that same point speaks to our relationship with State Street. She tried to characterize our relationship to State Street as distinct from other sponsor-administrator relationships because, you know, we have the power to terminate them, and we have the power to terminate them with 6 months' notice and so forth. That's all true of retirement plan sponsors, which have a fiduciary obligation, as she said, to monitor the performance of the plan administrator. And it's not the case that we actually controlled the activities of State Street somehow in an agency sense. It's true that we could terminate them, but they had explicit authority to act contrary to our wishes up until the point of termination, and they themselves have a fiduciary duty to plan participants. So the explicit authority to act contrary to our wishes and consistent with their fiduciary duty, their independent fiduciary duty to plan participants, takes us outside the realm of agency law. Thank you, Your Honors.
All right, thank you very much. Thanks to both counsel. We'll take